You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
It's just me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm joined today with my guest, Mike Grigsby. How are you doing? The Mike Grigsby. How are you doing today, Mike?
Sam, I am doing well. Thanks for having me on.
So you didn't give me a ton to go off of to introduce you. Now, you and I have already talked a lot, enough to know I was like, man, there's ample titles to choose from. Can you kind of spend a couple minutes here introducing yourself to folks as if they had just wandered off the street and you're like, hey, I'm Mike Grigsby, but you need to, I mean, they need to know who you are.
Sure. Sure. I think the easiest way, and it's probably what everybody associates me with, is I'm a retired police officer out of Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. Retired there in 2016. My last 4 years there, I served as the de facto CIO. We don't have that title, but I was the Information Services Division Commander and served basically as the CIO in that function. Most people know me for my technology background. I ended up leaving the police department, took the CIO role for our public transportation authority, and then later on became the CIO for a municipality in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. But aside from the technology side of that, I have been an executive and organizational coach for the last 25 years, working with people across the country and just helping them get out of their own way so that they can maximize their own potential.
It's fascinating. I could see why you lead with that one, but it is also fascinating that you lead with that one, right? Because it's like you've also been a forensic examiner at the FBI. And I feel like normally people might lean pretty hardcore into the FBI aspect of things. But I have noticed there's definitely, it seems like a trend at a bare minimum in the KCPD, right? Where it's like once in blue, always in blue. I don't even know. Is there a motto yet? Should we start that?
I think we could definitely start the motto. I think one of the things, though, is, and I read a book a long time ago. I can't remember exactly which book it was, but it says, you know, there's a difference between getting introduced as Bob Smith, the marketer, or Bob Smith, the Navy SEAL guy, right? I mean, you instantly have a different understanding, expectation, thoughts about or whatever, and makes it sound like I'm trying to game the system or whatever. But I find one that every time I introduce myself as a former police officer, I'm automatically in two camps, right? There's the maybe three camps, but there's the people that are like, hey, I know a cop, or hey, I was a cop, or I don't know that I like cops, but so far I'm tracking with you, you know? So it kind of puts people into it helps me orient that conversation pretty well.
Well, the cool thing is from a marketing position, it's polarizing either way, right? So even the person that's like, I don't like a cop, you have the opportunity to kind of like reset the scene and sure. That'll be confusing enough that it'll be memorable.
Well, I mean, right? I mean, you meet me on the street, I'm not a huge hulk of a man, you know, and so you say you have a police officer, you're like instantly like, well, if this guy could be a cop, well, maybe I could be a cop. Or, hey, this guy was likable. Maybe cops could be like, I mean, it creates a conundrum for whoever I'm talking to.
That's a fun thing to dive in on, though, because I would love to hit on that because you said, you know, I'm not trying to game the system or whatever, but I've noticed this even just for myself. So, you know, I've been in business now for like 6 years in August. And you have to kind of lean into marketing at some point or another. And I've noticed, you know, you play with one-liners, you play with titles. And I've noticed that if I'm a podcast host first, there's way more conversations and interesting things to talk about than if I'm a CIO first. It almost seems like it's... and so in that way, you know, in LinkedIn even, I've moved podcast hosts to the far left. And there's something for those of us that are inward looking. I don't know about you, but for me, it's always like, man, is that manipulative? And then it even harks back to the old How to Win Friends and Influence People book by Dale Carnegie, right? And it's like the book sounds manipulative by name, but it's really just how to be a good person.
Well, part of it is, and this is why it feels like you're gaming the system, right? Being intentional and deliberate about how you engage with people, for whatever reason, our society thinks you're gaming the system, right? But you don't just walk up to people and say, "Hi, I'm, you know, Mike Grigsby. I collect Star Wars characters." That's something crazy. For those Star Wars fans out there, that's not crazy. I don't do that, but I just want to make sure I'm not like, you know.
Well, like a great example would be if you just walked up with your political and religious affiliation, right? Okay. Just right out of the blue by label. Right. You're like, "Oh, hey, you know, I'm a Mormon," or whatever it is. You know what I mean? It's going to be immediately polarizing. Right. Well, I mean, we just don't do it.
We've seen this in the last several years with labels. Right. I mean, with not to open up a can of worms about it, but, you know, the whole pronouns. Right.
Yep.
There's a reason why people felt a need to be able to do that or needed to do that. That there's a reason for that. And I think it's not just that it's polarizing, but you're staking a claim into a framework of identity, right? And you can't be anything that you don't identify with. So, I mean, we could spin off into that conversation all you want, but identity sets your perspective, but it also defines your nature. How you show up, who you're going to be, and so forth. And, you know, I mean, there's probably not a person out there, maybe certainly in Western society, but there's probably not a person out there that hasn't faced at some point this imposter syndrome, right? And how do you get past that? Well, you get past it by establishing your identity and then working and living from and through that identity. So, yeah, there's a lot that we could talk about from that.
No, you're right. And so at some point, so let's kind of dig into, and you were in the Air Force at some point too. So normally we start the trend right around kind of the high school period. So if you wouldn't mind kind of giving me, what's your mindset then? What are the influences? What drove you into the Air Force?
Yeah, certainly. The truth be told, I actually had a small scholarship to go to an art college and right out of high school. And then I goofed around and missed my application window for the fall semester. And you know, at 18, your life is moving by at, you know, lightning speed. And I couldn't bear not being with my friends who were all going to school in the fall. So instead of waiting until January to go into college, I decided to enlist in the Air Force. My father was career Air Force. He was a fighter pilot, in Korea War and Vietnam. And, I had aspirations of following his footsteps, but, my eyesight did not allow me to, fly planes. So I ended up going into, electronics, became an electronics technician. I thought that was pretty cool. Ended up getting schooling for an electrical engineering degree, of which I have not been an engineer a single day in my life. But it sounded cool and looked like it was going to yield some good bucks coming out of the Air Force. Crazy things happened on this road called life. And I had a strange set of circumstances that got me into graphic design while I was in the Air Force. And we started working on this very, very nascent thing called the World Wide Web. We call it the Information Superhighway, right? That was back in 92, 93. And when I got out, I decided to, I actually tried to go into law enforcement then when I got out of the Air Force. And there was a hiring freeze for the Marshal Service, which I actually wanted to go into. And so I ended up getting a job as a graphic designer. And that turned into web development turned into marketing turned into an opportunity to become a CIO at some point. And it's maybe the dots seem weird to connect, but looking back through my own journey, they connect pretty seamlessly.
Well, and you gave an interesting reason to that end of joining the police force from, you know, something such as, you know, forensic examiner at the FBI and what you're saying you were doing with graphic design. Yeah. So can you tell me through that? Because even, you know, even when I was looking at it from a resume perspective, transparently, you know, forensic examiner at the FBI, and then what you're doing in graphic design, to then decide, you know, I want a police officer, definitely seems like a way different direction.
Well, so the sequencing is off just a little bit on that. So I was the marketing director and CIO for a mortgage bank in 2004. My wife wanted to move back to Kansas City. We were living in Texas at the time. She wanted to move back to Kansas City. We did. And I decided.
We're out in Texas again.
At the time, we were living in South Waco. That was before Waco was cool. But my job was in Austin. That was back when you could actually make it in about 45 to 50 minutes from Waco to Austin. You can't do that now. But we moved back to Kansas City, and I decided to scratch that itch. I had wanted to be a police officer since I was 12, and I decided to put in my application. And I actually put in an application for Secret Service and Kansas City Police Department at the same time, said whoever calls first, that's where I'm going. KCPD called, and that's where I ended up. And about 4 years into my time there at the police department, I ended up getting an appointment as it's a lateral change, but I got moved into a detective position. And from there, I was dispatched, assigned to an FBI forensic unit doing a computer forensics investigation, which is as cool as that job sounds.
Well, and if I'm honest, so forensic investigation sounds pretty cool on paper, and it's something that's always sounded cool to me from audio. But just in these different tech forums I'm in, the stuff you have to see as part of the job has never appealed to me. And frankly, for as much access and as much tech, I think it's been a God thing for me, at least. I've never really had to be exposed to that for any of the clients I've ever supported, and I've supported a lot of them. It's just never one of those things that's cropped up for me. But there was a whole post once that really was intriguing to me, because he was talking about a scenario where he'd seen all this stuff, and it was really difficult for him. And he was literally talking with his dad, and he was post-military. Mm-hmm. And his dad basically said, it's a service you and I do because we've both been broken, and it's better off that we do it than somebody that hasn't been. And that kind of stuck with me for some reason, because it's something I haven't had to deal with. So it's weird. I don't necessarily want to dive you too far down a black rabbit hole, but can you kind of enlighten a little bit as to what that process looks like, how common that crap is? Maybe this is something I'm describing where it's like, oh no, you run into that stuff maybe once every blue moon, but my guess is not. Yeah, my guess is that's a regular thing.
For the audience sake, we'll just go ahead and name it, and it's child pornography, right? And a lot of crimes against children and the child pornography, which is in the United States here, probably around the world, but definitely in the United States, it's illegal to produce or to own. You can't even possess it, and you face federal punishment, not just state or local. You face federal punishment even for possession of it. So just naming the thing that won't be named.
Thank you, by the way, because clearly I struggle to even name it.
No, I'm not trying to be crass about it, but you know, being able to talk about it is something that I hope, one, it will save a lot of those children victims, but two, people struggle. People wrestle with a lot of things, their own demons, their own psyche, and things along those lines. And you know, there's a beam of light that can be shown on something, and it helps somebody else out there. You know, let's talk about it. But you know,
to your point, the more difficult it is to talk about, the more prevalent it is, right? Because that's how. I mean, just. I know, and so in cybersecurity and with social engineering, I mean, I could say firsthand, the more difficult and crass and it's something is to talk about, the easier it is to prey on people, to manipulate them. Because if you can't even talk about it, then it's not a problem that you can solve. And if it's not a problem that you could solve, then those that are perpetuating the problem reign free.
Yeah.
So
I read a quote. This was just last week. I read a quote and I absolutely loved it. I've saved it, but it said that the only person coming to rescue you is the version of yourself that's fed up with what you're doing right now. And I love that. We can dive into that. I mean, there's so much to unpack in that. But the reality is the only people coming to save us meaning society from the ills that we have is the version of us meaning society that's fed up with it the way that it is. You know, having been a police officer, having been in the military overseas during campaigns, right? There's a narrative out there that we think somebody else is coming to rescue us. And sadly, we give up a lot of our own power for the sake of somebody else coming in to fix this for us. And it's not that other people can't help us, but I promise you every single situation is somebody helping themselves first. And by helping, I mean, you have to establish a mindset, a posture of like, we're done with this. Whether it's quitting smoking, whether it's quitting biting your nails, whether you're trying to get tighter abs at the gym, like there is a version of you that's tired of whatever current situation you're in. And that's the version of you that suddenly gains meaningful insights and ideas from nowhere that goes, I hadn't thought about this before, but now I'm open to it. I'm listening to it. I'm willing to go down that road. And you know, that's a lot of what I'm talking about comes through in my coaching, right? This is how, you know, in the coaching that I do, I exclusively work with people who have hit that 95% level of their potential, and they're just bumping up against a ceiling. They can't break through. Well, part of breaking through that is coming to terms with you are the one that's going to be able to do that. Not by brute force, not manhandling your ego or anything else. It really comes through surrender. And that's the toughest thing is for people, especially those A players, those people who are accomplished, those people who are successful. That last 5% called surrender is the hardest son of a gun for people to do. And they're the only ones that can do it. My role is really just kind of being a virtual Sherpa to help them navigate that mountain, you know. But, you know, circling back to, you know, the stuff that I was doing as a forensics investigator, I'd say about 70% of the work that I did was related to child pornography and, you know, those types of crimes. The other 30% were more white collar crimes or things that maybe there was a homicide or maybe there was an assault or something, and there was digital evidence associated with it. That was probably the other 30% of the work that I was doing. But other than that, it was I think this is kind of what you're talking about, how dark that is. There's a place, and I love that your friend was talking about, or your friend's dad was talking about, you know, we can do this because we've both been broken. I'm not going to try to psychoanalyze where that comes from, but you have to be in a place, and I'm just going to use this word, it's going to sound like a buzzword, but you have to be in a place of abundance to be able to do that. You can't do that from a place of lack. If you feel like you're just trudging through this, if you feel like you are here to save mankind from itself, you're gonna end up ruining yourself. I promise you that. You have to be able to do it from a place of abundance, from a place of competence, from a place of confidence. And what it allows you to do is not just compartmentalize, because there's a lot of people that can do that. It allows you to actually process, metabolize, and work through that, understanding the work and the significance of the work that you're doing.
Yeah, we have to talk about this so much more. So I'm going to take this a different direction. This is a perfect, it's a different direction, but it's in the same vein. And it's something that I've been just way too aware of, having friends and family in the police force. We're going to dive into your thing, because child pornography as 70% of a 40-hour week, let's assume, I've seen where it creates a mind, well, just in general. So it's a bit of a miracle thing for an officer to set aside their gun for any length of period of time. Most of the time they have on them or around them or near them, or they know where it's at. It's something constantly on their brain. And it's because they see shootings and homicides and, you know, all these different scenarios. They see people trying to swindle them out of X, Y, and Z on a regular basis, right? And so what I'm getting at here is you're seeing child pornography on a 70% basis on a 40-hour week. Now, I know that, and by contrast, I've seen like none of it in the field. And it's wild to me. Like, help me out here. You can create a mental space where you think it's everywhere and everybody does it all the time, yeah. Right? Because if it's 70% of a 40-hour work week, but in reality, that's your designated job, right? So you're seeing the hopefully fraction of a percentage concentrated onto your role.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I think if you take that thought and you extrapolate it out, the joke is never ask a cop where a good place to eat is in town, right? Or where the fun places are to go in town, because they spend so much time in the muck. They don't think about the
right.
Others. Now that's clearly a joke. But the point being is that you see such a concentrated amount of quote unquote bad stuff, that you get tainted, right? You get kind of, you know, you begin to see the bad in everything that you're doing. And in all honesty,
a better analogy, right, might be, hey, I have a life insurance and I want it to pay out, so I don't want it to be suicide. What neighborhood do I go to, right? A cop's going to know what neighborhood to go to pretty darn well.
I hope nobody's having that thinking. No, I hope nobody's having that thought.
No, and it's probably not even something I should mention. But to your point, that would be if you want a solid recommendation from an officer. Sorry, dark humor here on my end, I guess is what that was.
All right, just if we can take just a quick rabbit trail, I think it's important, right? It's dark humor. You and I get it, right? But there may be people in the audience who are either thinking that for real or have contemplated that, or maybe there's somebody just stuck trying to understand this difference between good and evil, and you know, right and wrong, and you know, cops and bad guys kind of thing. Right? So this is the book according to Mike. So let me just preface my thoughts from saying this, right? So as people begin thinking about this dark point or whatever, there's always a moment where you have to understand who you are and what you are bringing into every situation. When I was in the academy, probably week one, week two in the academy, and the instructor randomly asked the question, he's like, how many calls are you going to go on in your career that have a gun involved? And I'm like, how am I supposed to figure that, you know, calculus out? Well, the answer is all of them, because you bring a gun to every call that you go on. That shift in mindset of what you're bringing to the game, I tell you what, has been, you know, just a monumental shift for me, understanding that I'm not just there as some arbitrary third party who's completely neutral. I am always bringing something to the game, whether it is the last call that I just answered, whether it was the argument with my wife on my, you know, before I came on my shift, whether it was, you know, fill in the blank. I'm always bringing something to the game. You know, I mean, we always say this. You walk across the carpet and you touch the doorknob and you say, oh, the doorknob shocked me. The doorknob hasn't moved in 30 years. You moved across the carpet. You generated the static electricity.
Yeah.
Actually shocked the doorknob. But we say the doorknob shocked me, right? We forget what we bring to the equation. And it's so important, especially in a job like policing, but in every job, whether you're marketing, whether you're in healthcare, you have to understand you are part of the equation. You're not just some objective third party, you know, neutral third party in there. So it's essential to understand that, because as you begin unpacking like the work of law enforcement, which our society is needing to still do. As we begin unpacking that, you have to understand that there are multiple factors you know, coming into play in every one of those.
Yeah. Well, and man, there's another question there, but I want to make sure we loop back too, because I want to fully get your understanding. So I agree that each situation brings in bias, and you spawned that off of, you know, I made a dark joke with regards to bias and, you know, what you might ask a police officer. So, and then again, kind of, well, and I guess maybe that's kind of the point, right? Is so if 70% of your working week is viewing these things as a part of your job, these crimes, you might start to think that everybody's a criminal, right? Realistically speaking, which is 100% of the work week anyway. Well, seeing criminal
so
acts.
One of the reasons and for anybody that may be out there that is a corrections officer, you have my highest respect, because you are in an environment where presumably 100% of the people you are interacting with outside of your coworkers are convicted criminals, right? When I'm a police officer, I may go on one call where I have to make an arrest. I may go on another call that's just a 911 hang up, or I may go on another call where it's rescuing the proverbial cat out of the tree, or a check the welfare on somebody who hasn't heard from grandma in 3 days, right? The likelihood that I will not encounter a criminal act is pretty high, right? So being able to make the swing between all of the different types of calls that I go on, first of all, that's part of the game. The other part of it is understanding that we are asking officers to go on, and apologies for the morbidity here, but maybe go on a double homicide call. Yeah. And as soon as they leave that as a patrol officer, I'm not going to stay there and investigate. I got to get back on and answer 911 calls for service. I have to leave that and go answer a 911 hangup call. I have to go take a report on a non-injury accident. Like, I have to unpack that or compartmentalize it or fully metabolize it, which is the optimal way of doing, fully metabolize that, and then go on and do the other things that, like, immediately behind that, right? So just understanding the nature of the game. And I love Sir Robert Peel, who was born in England and is kind of known as the father of modern day policing. He reminds us in his Peel's principles, he reminds us that public safety is the responsibility of every single citizen. There are just some who have elected to make that a profession. It doesn't mean that it's not the rest of the society's responsibility. And it also doesn't mean that the police officers don't also have a responsibility to be citizens, right? That door, that flow goes both ways. And so it is, sadly, there's too many officers out there that either bring into, typically not, but because they get jaded or because they see that concentration of bad things, they get jaded, and now they start to feel like it's their responsibility to quote unquote take out the trash. I think the most effective thing, Arbinger Institute does a great job of reminding us of this. The best thing is for us to adopt the position that we are dealing with human beings first and foremost, right? Don't objectify them. Don't say, you know, they're bad guys. Don't say they're scum. Don't say that, right? That it's a human being who has adopted a behavior right now or is acting out a behavior that is incongruent with what society wants, right? And so if you understand that they're a human being, and that human being can be on the spectrum anywhere from Mother Teresa to Adolf Hitler, right? At any moment, if you understand that, then you are actually ready to render the highest level of human service, or ready to respond in the most tactically effective way in that situation, right? With the whole purpose of quote unquote rendering the scene safe, right? We can dive into that for weeks on end, but that's the idea. And going back to your question around, you know, 70% of the my work week, I think it's important to also understand that for me, that job did not spend time across the table dealing with suspects or going arresting suspects or anything else. I spent a lot of time in front of a computer screen not knowing who the individual was whose computer I'm looking at, I can extrapolate a whole. The point is, it is very objectified, right? All I am doing is looking for evidence. I'm not building a judgment. I'm not building a case. I'm not building an idea of who this individual is, right? All I'm looking for is evidence. And the minute I find evidence, I don't have to camp out on it. I don't have to explore it. I just need to know, yes, this qualifies, done, that's set aside. I go look for more. And the minute I find evidence, even if it's just one piece, that system is quote unquote bought and paid for, right? It qualifies for, you know, for prosecution. So I don't have to spend time. And maybe that's the part of the reason why.
So from a compartmentalization perspective, you were almost capable of, well, and I hate to say this because we were talking about jading and whatnot, but I'm just thinking about my mental positioning. You were able to almost think of it as like it's evidence. It's black and white. It's a piece of paper. It's a smoking gun. That's it. It's not who, I don't care who shot it. I don't care where the bullet went. I don't care that it was, I don't know if it was Winston Churchill that the bullet went through or not. I just know it was a smoking gun and there it is. And that's the extent of what I'm going to think of it as. Checkbox, move on.
Correct. Unfortunately, I mean, you know, note to everyone, everything has a digital signature, right? So
yeah.
If, you know, the child pornography side is such a small niche, criminal act out there, people are recirculating the same images around. Well, okay. Once I find that, I don't even have to look at those. We determine that those are already evidence. I don't even have to look at that, right? It's been processed, it's been vetted, it's been identified and accepted. I don't even have to look at those images. I just now have to go scour through other stuff.
I have a wild question. I'm trying to decide if I even want to ask it. But so in piracy, it's my understanding that certain producers or publishers of movies will purposely put out pirated copies that are tracked, so that way they can then identify who's enacting in piracy, and then typically they issue reports and warnings, and then they'll eventually prosecute.
Right.
You know what I'm going to ask is something like that. Is that done in cases of child pornography? Like there's one that's been around the block a few times, and now we're going to tag it and let it go.
It gets tagged. It gets tagged from a standpoint of this is known child pornography. Mm-hmm. If it ever shows up anywhere, we don't have to go through the process of verifying and somebody look at it and confirm. It's already tagged in that sense. I don't know that I surely hope there isn't some agency out there that's putting stuff out there for the purpose of tracking it. Now, I say that maybe there is some essence of that from a sting operation or something like that, but I'm not aware of anything like that.
Yeah,
good Fair. Question.
So sure. To kind of leap back and dive in a little bit more on the jading, because you even described a scenario, a good one, I think, where you mentally put child pornography into the bucket of smoking gun. It's evidence. That's all we're going to think of it as. And then we're going to kind of move on. Jading is an interesting thing to me because on one hand, I definitely would agree that in the main, you kind of want to avoid it. But it's also it's a mental protection, right? To some end, depending on how it is and how far it goes. And I'll use myself as an example. The most jaded I think I ever got was working internet help desk. You know, have you tried unplugging it and plugging it back in, right? And there was your first 3 to 6 months or whatever, you're pretty green and eager and ready to please, right? And willing to believe and listen to people. And then something happens, and next thing you know, you just don't believe anybody anymore. And I'm going to have you unplug it and plug it back in while we're on the call, even if you told me you already did it. And unless I believe that you did it while we were on the call in that moment, we're stuck here in this weird sort of... And it's It's, I don't know. It's, for me, it was a mental protection against, you know, people call screaming and yelling. And I'll give a contrast. You know, I had a buddy of mine, and he was clearly incapable of becoming jaded, which on one hand you would think, wow, fantastic. He's the guy I want on the phone. But you see how he would come home from a full day of it, you know, and we're hanging out and it's like, dude, today sucked. I'm like, why did today suck? Oh, I just got screamed at, man. The last call was so-and-so and they yelled at me for 40 minutes straight. And I couldn't quite understand because I'm over here like, those calls didn't bother me at all. Because I'm going to be honest, the moment the person started screaming, I just shut down my brain. The whole thing went down. And then I repeated, I'm sorry. You know, I apologize that you feel this way. I'd like to help you as much as I can. You know, just these platitudes that transparently didn't mean a whole lot because I had already shut down my brain. But I knew eventually they'd run out of steam and they'd decide, do I want your Sam's help or am I going to hang up the phone now mad? Yeah. And I had no barrier. But the cool thing is I'd end each day, if somebody screamed at me for 100 calls straight, it did not ruin my day. I loved when people were thankful and excited. And yeah, that meant a lot. But people being upset wasn't a huge deal. By contrast, my buddy, you could tell it really weighed on him. You could tell it was like, it was upsetting because it was like a 5 days, two or three of them would be like,
oh yeah,
just earth shattering. Yeah. And I couldn't understand it because I'm like, why don't you? So it's an interesting thing to me. The more I think about it, the more it's like, it's clearly a mental trigger to protect you. But you're right. If you end up in a scenario where everybody's a criminal, or even my scenario, transparently, when I worked 1-800 Internet Help Desk, I may not have been the best call. I don't know. I was pretty darn good at my job, which was keeping the call at about 12 to 13 minutes and trying to make sure you didn't call back. So the problem was solved once and for all. So I like to think most folks enjoyed getting me on the phone, but I don't know. I don't know.
So I'm tracking with what you're saying, you know, that it's a mental protection. And I think it's an ego protection, right? So, you know, from a help desk standpoint, I mean, this is where the ID10T character or, you know,
qualifier
comes from, right? If I think the other person on the other end of the phone is an idiot, right? That puts me, first of all, you've objectified them. They're no longer human. They're an idiot, right? An idiot is kind of a nondescript, right? It's an object, not a person, right? So first of all, I've dehumanized them. I can no longer empathize with an object. So now this is a one-way transference of feeling and emotion, and it's all mine. I can't even hear yours because you're an object. Objects can't have feelings and emotions. So the only thing that's being processed right here is my emotions, right? That's not good service. The idea, I'll say this. I
do want to go on record too with, I don't think I ever used any of those acronyms. I'm going to be honest. I'll give myself a little credit here. I don't, and there was a guy, now I'll admit, I shoot myself in the foot again here. I admired him. There was a guy that was so good at the mute button that he could insert curse words into the conversation and you had zero clue it was happening. And the first time I heard it, I was just like in shock. And I looked over and I'm like, what are you doing? Are you ready to quit? You're just trying to get fired. And he's over there like the mute button. And I'm like, man, and anybody that knew him from the help desk too. And that I'm aware of, he never got fired because he was just good enough at it that nobody ever knew.
But the goal would be to not have to use the mute button. Right. The goal would be to be in a position and have an orientation to that where the mute button isn't even necessary. I will. What I was going to say is I would love if there's somebody in your audience that's listening to this. Here's a grand idea. If you want to use artificial intelligence to come up with a call answering solution for call centers that can automatically detect irate cursing, yelling, customers, and automatically just disconnect the line. That should be standard software that it should be able to pick that up, because the reality is they called in for a problem, but to get a problem resolved, but they're so emotionally heightened that they're trying to express that they need a relief valve. Well, that's not, you're there to solve their problem, not to be the relief valve. And that's not to dismiss what they're feeling. It's just, it's being aimed into a place that can't handle it. You're not a psychologist. You're not a counselor or anything else that can help them work through their emotions. You know how to fix a computer, right? You know how to get them. And unless and until you can get there and do that. So I'm just saying that's we can edit that out later on, but,
I don't think we necessarily need to, unless it's, but honestly, it took me a long time to realize that, at least for me personally, human facing IT is a lot more psychiatry than you would ever expect, because to that, so you have to, you have to de-escalate the situation. And I'll never forget one of my phone calls. There's not a lot of phone calls I remember anymore, because that was like, man, 10 years, a long time ago. And frankly, I remember days after blotting out just as much as possible, because it, you know, it's 8 months and you're burned out. The average person made it like 3 to 6. People started remembering your name if you stayed there for 6 months. That's how bad it was. Nobody knew your name. I had been there for 6 months and all of a sudden everybody was like, Sam, right? Like, I just thought I was never going to have social interaction. Yes, my name is Sam. And it's like, and I know your name. I've known all of your names. And it's like, anyway, but to come back to Jaded, that was just the washout was so. But okay, so I'll never forget a call. This woman called in. She visits her husband like once a month at a gravesite. And, you know, she didn't have internet. And the only time she's ever going to be up there is on the weekend. And this particular internet provider didn't dispatch on the weekend. They only dispatched Monday through Friday. And so I'm over here trying to be empathetic and trying to be understanding, while at the same time telling her, like, I just don't know. It's 5 p.m. on a Saturday night. You've checked two boxes. And you're telling me that you only come up once a month on the weekend and you're not planning on changing that. And I understand you're empathetic here, you're upset, not because the internet's out, but because your late husband. But I also don't know how to tell you that your internet probably isn't going to be back if you don't make a special Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday trip and we get a tech schedule then. Like, I'm stuck between a rock and a hard place. And so, well, yeah, it is wild how much of it, you know, I don't feel like, maybe it's just me, but I don't feel like a ton of roles go out there to learn carpentry and then find out it's like most of your job is actually going to be psychotherapy.
I get that, but that psychological burden on that is, I think, and this is just my own anecdotal experience, right? I think a lot of that is self-imposed. I'll give you a perfect example. So I think I might have shared this with you when we met, but I remember it was the first summer that I was on patrol, and summertime is always, I mean, it's just one call after another, called. And my partner and I, we patrolled an area where we had an apartment complex that we were constantly being dispatched there. A lot of criminal activity and so forth. We were constantly there, probably 6-7 times a shift, we were at that apartment complex. And we were leaving a call. We had already been there like 2 or 3 times already that day. We were leaving a call. And I remember as we're pulling out of the apartment complex, I made the comment, I said it out loud. I said, we just need to napalm this entire complex. And my partner probably acknowledged it or said something or nodded or whatever the case was. And I don't remember what his response was, but I remember my immediate response. In my head, I started thinking, really? Really, Mike? We need to napalm the entire complex? There's nobody here that's just a normal working person trying to make ends meet and trying to scratch their way through life. Really, we need to napalm? Like, that noodled on me and needled me all night long. I couldn't think about it. And the next night, or the next day, I went back on my shift, and I just had a mental pivot that I was like, I get to do this job. Nobody made me. It wasn't a draft. I didn't get conscripted to do this. I volunteered to do this job. I get to do this. And it was a reality that I get to show up as a police officer. I get to show up in a moment where adults have either forgotten how to adult, or their adulting skills in that moment are such that they require another adult to come in and mediate, right? Like, understanding that. And so it became my mission, if you will, of how can I render the highest level of dignity first to anyone that I meet, right? That's the first thing you're going to get is dignity. Second of all, because I've only known you for the last 8 seconds, you're not going to get my judgment. I'm going to look and observe very impartially what's going on here, why I'm here legally, and then I'm going to disposition that call however it needs. You might go to jail. It might end in lethal force. It might. I mean, there's a spectrum of ways that can be dispositioned. But the fact that I went in and changed that from a rendering dignity first, because these are human beings who are probably in the worst moments, one of the worst moments of their lives when the police get called. Like, understanding that changes, and why I'm tying that to being jaded is that being jaded came from me. It wasn't because of the scenario. It wasn't because of the situations that I was going to. Those are impartial. Those are not good, not bad, whatever, right? That they just require me by law to come in and do something. The jading was of my own volition. I chose to that way. And that's what ends up happening is that comes from a place where you feel, the individual feel, like you are doing all of this and you're not getting any reciprocity on it. There's no benefit, no value. There's not cooperation going on. Like, when you're on the call with the IT customers, I'm not getting cooperation from you. You need to help me help you help me, right? That you're not getting that. And that's what leads to feeling jaded. Well, if you can shift your mind, make that same mental pivot and understand you are there by virtue of your job description to solve these individuals' problems related to computers, yes, you're going to get the psychological side. I would agree that policing has such a high degree of psychology attached to almost every call that you're in. It's heightened emotion, most of it, right?
Yeah.
If you can understand that and realize your job is not to solve the emotional part of that problem, that's not what you have been hired to do. You are there to help walk through that, to navigate that, so that you can get to the problem that needs to be solved. And, you know, I'll finish this thought by there was a statement that they made in the academy, and it said, "They can have the last word. You'll always have the last act." And I think that applies. That's not just for policing. I think that applies to a lot of different jobs, right? Not that you have to be, you know, hear their, you know, just their berating or whatever it is all the time. But the reality is their words aren't going to change what you're going to do. From a policing standpoint, you're going to be arrested because I showed up and I'm the one with the badge. You're going to be arrested. You can call my mom whatever you want to call my mom. You can say whatever you about my nose or what. Like, you can say those things, and it's not going to change the fact that you're still going to go to jail because of the circumstances and evidence that's here, right? The same can be applied, maybe a little bit, you know, you got to think through it a little bit more, but same could be said for an IT job or, God forbid, the DMV, right? Right?
Right.
We can think through that and understand what we're there to do. And just kind of take our cues from that, not from the circumstances that are playing it.
Well, and to that, so I was trying to think through, and I wish I could pinpoint a particular day like you can. I don't think I quite can, but I'll give a shout out to small business. The moment I kind of went from corporate being, for lack of any better word, or feeling like, but a cog in the machine. You know, I remember a specific scenario where, like, I'm trying to make the job better, and my manager one day, great, great guy, very lead by example sort of leader, and he's like, you know, do you think I can do anything about it? I was like, no. Do you think anybody in this room can do anything about it? It's like, no. It's like, okay, so maybe complain a little bit less. And I did. I complained a little bit less, but I also got a little bit more jaded because I was like, man, he's so right. This corporate machine is so massive that my opinion and those around me really don't matter at all. And those a level or two above me don't matter at all. And then when I switched to small business, it was completely different. And I'd always been dedicated to being the best that I could be at my role. And I think when I entered small business and that just became this massive, deep, like there are so many things that you can do because you're so valued, because you're wearing so many hats, because you're right. One of five, one of 10, one of 15, maybe even one of 50. That's still a pretty small business. And so, you know, complete contrast. It's interesting. Towards the end there, they had a whole title for me. They called me the Peach Whisperer. I would get the more difficult folks. And what was wild to me is they called them peaches. They had this, you know, instead of Peach being a very lovely person, Peach was a particularly difficult person. They'd say, we've got a Peach on the phone. What was interesting to me is part of why I guess I was the Peach Whisperer is I never saw them as a peach. The moment I got them on the phone and I just listened, right, for 15 minutes straight in some cases. And then you get to the end and you're like, well, no wonder you're upset. It's like, okay, so you told me that like you had this going on and then this situation happened and then this situation happened. And the reality is you're just trying to solve it expeditiously now. And you're also heightened and upset because of X, Y, Z. Let's go. And then in the moment they realize you understand, right? The moment they realize you understand that it was a Friday night at 5:01 and you had to get out a quote that was worth XYZ. And if you didn't get out the quote on time and the quote was missed and, you know, I still have the problem Monday morning. So that's just like salt in the wound. And then the moment you level with them, right, which is like, okay, here was the situation on our end and why that happened, like the after hours alert system broke or whatever it was, right? And then the moment they understand, and they also understand that like, okay, now what can we do to make this right? It's wild to me. I mean, in most scenarios, it's actually funny. I do have one or two exceptions in my head, but in like 99% of the scenarios where I don't think you're maybe dealing with some sort of sociopath or something, everybody comes around. Everybody's like, and I'm the same way. I just want to be understood. If I'm calling in mad or upset or I get to that point, right? It's never about they had an accent or I couldn't understand them, or it's always about I had a story that I was trying to tell.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And somewhere I thought I was speaking English and they heard Greek. Yep. And I don't know where I went wrong in telling the story. And I don't know where they went wrong in hearing the story. But now I'm upset. It has nothing to do with it. It just has everything to do with the fact that obviously I need a problem solved. But it's all in that story, right? It's like I'm trying to explain to you what the problem is, and it's all in that story. And most of the time, people in tech especially, they don't really know. Like, they know I've got this problem, and they know I need to describe the symptoms. But and it's the same thing when I roll into the mechanic shop, right?
Yep.
It's like, all right, I'm ready to feel like a dork. There's a dinging under the hood. And when I speed up, it slows down. But it really only seems like it's at 55 miles an hour after I hit a pothole. And, you know, what does that mean? Then they're over there like, Okay, can you say that into the microphone here? We just want to get that recorded because that's like the most comical thing we've heard today. It's like, all right, okay. I just need my car fixed, please.
Well, I mean, the feeling that you're talking about is one of, you know, I mean, it's embarrassing, right? But you feel exposed, right?
And, yeah.
And that's why our egos kick in to prevent that. It's not a cool feeling. Being exposed is not a cool feeling. So our ego's like, oh, I got this. Watch. I'm going to sound like I know what I'm talking about. I really don't, but I'm going to sound like I know what I'm talking about. And I'm going to come up with some really cockamamie way of, you know, whatever it is, right? Our egos do a great job of protecting it from that feeling of exposure or that feeling of embarrassment or that feeling of being found out or that feeling of, you know, I think it was, Malcolm Gladwell. I think it's either Malcolm Gladwell or Seth Godin, one of the two authors, but one of them said that, you know, it's like if the true penalty of rejection is the feeling of being rejected, go ahead and do whatever it was you're going to do anyway. Right. If the only outcome is just the feeling of being rejected, don't ever not do what could be profound and utterly, you know, monumental. Don't not do that because you're afraid of feeling rejected. Now it sucks. That's a terrible feeling. It does not feel good. But at the cost of losing who you think you are, losing your own identity, losing your authenticity and genuineness to the rest of the world because you thought you were going to feel rejection, you didn't want to process that feeling, that puts things into a whole new light.
Right. And I think one to another angle, though, too, I agree with the rejection element. But I also sometimes wonder if from a potential evolutionary perspective, you know, you go back to tribalism, and I may be completely off base here. I think people in general tend to be social creatures. But I have a sense that in some end, you know, when you're in a world where, you know, your kids are the farmhands and your kids' kids are the farmhands, the more kids we have, the bigger the farm we have, the bigger the, and I'm just going back to like, when I say farm, I mean like tent and sheep and sheep herders. If you show significant weakness to the other person, you know, and it's like, you know, hey, the whole family's sick. Yeah, I'm not sure we'll make it through winter, right? And then you're the other person, and what you don't know is the other person's farm. They're going through a drought, and their whole family is hungry. It's like, okay, well, all right, if we come and kill you now, which you said you might not make it through winter anyway, then all of a sudden I get to feed my family, right? And so we almost enter a world where, yes, rejection is difficult. Yes, being vulnerable is difficult. But also maybe there's something still deep down in there that says, careful, you might get killed if you're honest. Careful, you might get killed if you're vulnerable. Careful, don't look stupid. Don't look like you don't know what you're doing. Because they might come after you. They'll take advantage of it.
Killing probably was a real thing back in the tribe times. I mean, that was probably here. But that killing now, I think it comes in terms of excommunication, right? We're going to excommunicate you from the tribe if you violate it, if you don't show up the right way. And I'll say this, again, this is the book according to Mike, but I think we are wired for tribal community. We are wired for community. The tribe is a really, really important thing, but it is not the most important thing. And I think we have learned, and certainly we have programmed ourselves into feeling an obligation to the tribe as opposed to a genuine desire to see the tribe thrive, right? It's one thing. And this goes back to the guy with the mute button, right? I can sound nice by hitting the mute button, but what's really going on is I'm pissed. I don't want to talk to you. You're an idiot. That's what's really going on. So the fact that it looks nice is not really being nice. So it's harming you and it's harming me. So we come to the tribe because of this perceived obligation to the tribe. We come into the tribe through like dragging our feet. I don't want to be doing this. I don't want to have to give you these things. I got my own stuff that I got to deal with. We're in this neighborhood and my house is being broken into same as yours, or we're in this business together and I got my job to do just like yours. We go into the tribe with this dragging feet kind of notion. And the reality is we should be going into the tribe full of a heart, with a heart full of abundance, with a heart full of like, I get to do this. I get to help you. I'm coming from a place of excess. I'm coming from a place of abundance. Well, if you don't feel that, and that you get that by taking care of yourself, right? If you don't take care of yourself, you can't bring anything to the tribe. So you're always coming back to the tribe through a lens of lack as opposed to a lens of offering or giving or abundance. And it's huge. I mean, every time anybody that's flown on an airplane, one of the things that we hear them say is like, put your mask on first before you can go take care of anybody else. Even your child, even your infant child, put your mask on. They tell us in the police department, you have to arrive at the scene if you're going to be helpful at the scene. Don't do something on your way there that jeopardizes your own safety because you're no good to anybody if you can't get to the scene, right? It's, we think about this. We hear it in all these other kind of contexts, and it makes sense. But when it comes to the tribe, our family, our company, our community, we can't make that correlation. We can't find the stickiness of that correlation in those contexts.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot there. I'm trying to think towards the next question, if I'm being honest. There's a lot to kind of go over. So let's move past the police force, right? Sure. Let's move past the, so what is it, and catch us back up again. What is it you're doing now? You've had quite a few evolutions, since then. What is it you're doing now, and who are you doing it for?
So in the middle of, my CIO, public sector CIO time, I got recruited away by Cisco Systems to help build smart cities around the globe. And, it was an interesting time, right? For the audience, the term smart cities, if you're not familiar with it, is basically the ability of a city to leverage data to more effectively address civic issues, right? So crime, we have all this data. We can crunch that and figure out how we can either get ahead of things or whatever. For traffic, we can analyze all the data of what's happening through our traffic control signals so that we can better control them for rush hour or for events or parks and recreation. We understand how people are using the park. Now we can activate that and program in a way that's more meaningful to activate it even more or to make the experience that much better. So that's what smart cities is. It always gets this kind of gets filtered through a technology lens, but technology is not only way to have a smart city. But over the last 20 years, really, that's kind of been, over the last 15 years anyway, that's really been this lens. Is there's been a huge, huge push around the data side of it, which is necessary, but that's not the only way that you could do it. So again, a smart city is finding ways for faster pattern recognition. What's the thing that's happening? And then smarter resource allocation. Okay. Now that we know this thing is happening, what's our appropriate and corresponding response to this thing that we know, or even how can we respond to it before it even happens? Right. So that's what I got involved in. And I just at the time that I got introduced to that, Kansas City was putting a very, very conspicuous stake in the ground around its foray into this thing called smart cities. And it just allowed me, it offered me a ton of opportunity to speak, one, because of what was happening in Kansas City, but two, because I was also working with a global company called Cisco, I could go and have audience with a lot of different people talk about that. And it just gave me a platform for a lot of kind of what I'll call thought leadership recognition And that's been the space that I've been playing in effectively probably since 2016, maybe even a little bit longer than that. And so it informs kind of what I do now. So I do a lot of strategic business development for technology organizations because many of them are trying to, especially those that have a public sector offering, many of them are trying to be in that smart city space. One of the companies that I'm working with right now is called Ubiquia. They are an intelligent infrastructure company, and they have found a way to leverage existing infrastructure called through these things called streetlights, of which there's hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands in cities. They're able to leverage that to deploy IoT or cameras and other sensors for gathering data. So I do a lot of that. And then I also continually consult with municipalities, consult with police agencies, continue to help them on their public safety technology solutions. You know, it's interesting, even in 2025, the majority of our police chiefs across the country do not have a technology background. And technology is a major factor in public safety, strategic planning, and certainly tactical operations. But there's a kind of a deficit, if you will, and I don't mean that pejoratively to anybody, right? It's just not the way that they were trained coming up. Most of them right now probably have 25 years on the job. And so you go back 25 years, that's not how they were trained to think. And it certainly, most of them will have a criminal justice background. Point being is that there still needs to be somebody that has the deep knowledge around technology. And I don't mean just the ones and zeros of it. I mean the smart application, the strategy side of this. How do we get the adoption in there? How do we get the outcomes? What should we be looking at? And most importantly, how should we, once the go live switch gets thrown, how do we start thinking about what the next milestone is going to be? Because there is no place called smooth sailing. Done does not exist. So if you don't have this idea of continuous adoption, continuous evolution, you're going to be behind the curve the minute you get something deployed. And it doesn't matter whether you're policing, whether you're marketing, whether you're healthcare, it doesn't matter. Technology is a very in the face reminder that there is no place called done.
No, it hits on an interesting point. I've got one we're reviewing right now. I've been through so many migrations, and it's funny, for as much as the technology behind the scenes changes, the migration is almost kind of universally the same. And then it's like, okay, in a lot of cases, right, you kind of already know what you're going to go to. There's an interesting scenario here kind of coming up where it's like, what app do we go to? Or do we go to another app? Or do we develop our own app? And it's interesting to me because it really kind of all comes down to budget. And that's basically what I said was, it's like, okay, what kind of budget are we talking about? Because I'm being serious. It's like, we either have a budget to develop an app, in which case we review whether or not that's necessary because we might be able to find a cheaper solution out there in the wild. But if we don't have the budget to develop the app, then we can kind of save money on consulting if that makes the most sense. And then we can go straight to trying to find an app in the wild. And we should probably know and have everybody on board with the fact that if we find one in the wild, that's probably going to be about 75% of what we need. And the other 25% is going to be the stuff that we've just all agreed are the features that aren't necessary that we can kind of do without. And hopefully we'll get additional features that'll excite us a little bit that we didn't have before. And having everybody on board with that notion now will make it easier for adoption. Okay, so as we all know, business never really stops, especially in small business. Okay, so we were talking about smart cities, and I figured out kind of the question I've wanted to ask, and I've been trying to figure out exactly how to ask it, and now I think I've got it. So you mentioned smart cities. And part of the reason I've been trying to figure out how to ask it is because I'm also trying to avoid making it political, but I don't know how to avoid that fully either. So you mentioned smart cities, right? You mentioned collecting data and growing cities and this, that, and the other. And this has been kind of a bit of a, transparently, a growing concern of mine. We have Kansas City that is definitely growing. Do you think, oh man, how do I ask this? I don't, we're just going to plow through and go with it, and I'll let you try to translate and decode. So Kansas City is definitely growing, right? I mean, and I don't know the full logistics on the back end from a smart city's perspective. I would hope Kansas City has a much better metric on that. I just know I'm literally meeting people from Moldova that are like, I travel the United States and I like Kansas City, so I stay. And then, you know, and sometimes the answer is we came for a Chiefs game. We liked the people. We liked the city. And so we stayed. And sometimes the answer is, I got married, had a baby, and honey wanted to be close to the family. So here we are in Kansas City. You hear that a lot. That's like the majority. Anyway, but either way, Kansas City is growing. I think, you know, go Chiefs. I think Super Bowl is definitely helping. Do you think we're making an appropriate investment in the KCPD to grow with the city? Because if I'm honest, my chief concern right now is that we are in this growing pain period where it's like we're on track to become a Chicago. But unlike Chicago, who in the nicer areas for sure has like a police officer on every street corner. Like, I don't know when the last time you were in Chicago was, but those cop cars just park on the median. And you'll just like, you're walking and it's cop car in the other corner, cop car in the other corner. And it's why I never saw or had any chaos up there. So I don't know why so many cop cars. But then if there's the threat of potential, like, you know, something political is happening right now and there's the threat of it break, then there's like cop cars, like not even on every street corner, but on like every corner. Every mid block, it's like two cop cars to a block. It's wild how many police officers. I'm like, I've never seen these many police officers. And then you come to Kansas City, and my chief concern is that we still have, for as many districts and as many officers as we probably have, my big concern is we're still thinking small midtown. And we're now in a position between mid-big town. And so the question is, do you think we're making the investment there that we need to?
So let's start with math, right? So Kansas City proper has just over 500,000 people from a population standpoint. I think right now the approved level of officers, of sworn officers for Kansas City Police Department is 1,600. I think my math may be off on that a little bit. Let's call it 1,500. Okay, 1,500 for an approved force. 1,500 divided by 500,000 gives you 0.002 or 0.003, something like that, right? So that's the percentage, that's the ratio of officers to population, right? Add to that, that Kansas City is the anchor city of a 2.5 million population metro area where you have a daytime population inside the city of Kansas City upwards of around 1.2. So half of the metro population is inside for work or for passing through or whatever. Almost half of that population, metro population, is inside the city of Kansas City. So trying to answer the question of, do we have enough officers, which I think is maybe the base part of what you're saying. Do we have enough officers? Is you have to ask the existential question, is how many officers is enough? If we have 0.003% or 0.003 on a ratio to our citizens, like the police are far outnumbered. The question becomes, one, should we even try to get that many, a better number, higher number, right? And is that number 2,000? Is that number 2,500? Is that number 10,000, right? New York, every city out there, you have a terrible ratio of officers to citizens, you know, unless you're living in a town of 12, right? The ratio just is not good. So I'm setting this up for a very for a very needful postulation, meaning in 2025 and beyond, we have to start thinking about public safety in a very different way than we have historically thought about public safety. The people are different. The nature of society is different. The nature of the crimes are different. We have so many other tools and so forth at our disposal, but we are, to your point, we see cars out there all the time. We see officers out there. There's this idea of safety that comes from seeing people in uniform and having a physical touch, not physical touch, but a physical interaction with somebody out there, right? We have to begin thinking. I'm not here to tell you I have the answer, right? I'm just willing to jump into the conversation and go, okay, what could it be? If any one of us was designing a 500,000 population city today from the ground up, we probably would not say, let's have 1,300 police officers. Okay? Because we see the difference of that. Failure's not the right word. We see the misses that represents. We have technology now, and I'm not here just to advocate for technology, but we have tools and resources out there that can be force multipliers, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that we really need to do as a metropolitan, and it's not just Kansas City. I could say this for Phoenix, for Denver, for Dallas, large cities. You need to begin thinking of solutions in terms of a metro, of a regional solution, not just an individual municipality. So I'll use Kansas City as an example. One, because I know it well, and two, because it's representative of this challenge that I'm talking about. So in Kansas City, you have two states. You got Kansas and Missouri. You have 19 counties in the metro area. You have 122 different municipalities. Not all of those have their own policing, their own police force, but many of them do. And all of them are working on what is necessary for their respective municipality, right? Their respective jurisdiction. The reality is you, me, and the rest of the 2.5 million people in this area, we crisscross and traverse those jurisdictional boundaries as if they didn't exist. And the only people that are focused in on the jurisdictional boundaries are the jurisdictions themselves, right? We know, I know this from just a pure public safety standpoint, the criminals that are here in Kansas City aren't necessarily from Kansas City. And the ones that are here in Kansas City don't necessarily commit crimes only in Kansas City. They are moving across those jurisdictional boundaries just like we do as, you know, Joe Q citizen. So we have to start thinking about metropolitan solutions. Well, therein lies the rub. How do we share taxes? How do we share, you know, costs, fees? How do we share that as a regional base? Well, we haven't figured that out yet, but we need to. We really, really, really need to do this. I meet with police agencies on a regular basis, and everybody can shake their head or nod their head and say, yes, we need to do that. We're not going to get that done, right? There needs to be a substantial change in the way we're qualifying the problem as opposed to just continuing to do it the way we've always done it. I think that we should have more police officers, but that's not the only solution, right?
Yeah.
I think we should have more firefighters, but that's not the only solution. We have to think about this. We should have more EMS. We should have more fill in the blank, right? But that's not the only way to address that problem. And I think unless and until we are ready to start contemplating how we can solve it from a regional standpoint, I think we're going to keep running up into this question of how many more officers are we going to get? And I think, you know, what do you get, you know, from a tax base increment or a budget increase every year? Maybe you get 20 new officers, maybe you get 60, maybe you get 100, right? But out of that, you're going to filter out through the academy. You're going to have natural attrition and everything. So maybe it's a net positive. More often than not, it's a net neutral, right? So, we have to start thinking about that problem in a very, very different way. Sorry, you opened up your arms with that one.
No, and it's a good can of worms. It's one I want to talk about. So like it's got me thinking, to your point, what's a good ratio? And it's interesting, Omaha has a really close, obviously much different city dynamics, but it has a very similar population.
Similar thing going.
Yeah, 20 to 50,000. And I would be interested, now I don't know what their crime situation does or doesn't look like or their net growth, but it would be interesting to see what ratio police force they have. And then to that end, I mentioned Chicago. Now, the areas I've specifically been to have been more like the pier and places like that, which those might be completely different then. But it would be interesting to see what their ratio is as well. As like comparisons, because to your point, I guess I don't even know. I would agree that sounds like an abysmal number, but it would also be interesting to see these cities that are similar to and or further along on a population growth perspective, what they've done.
Well, so let me come back to this, to the ratio, right? Because I think one of the mistakes that we are making, and it may be just kind of a...
I agree, by the way. We're kind of focusing on a symptom
Maybe even not even so much of a symptom. I'm having a difficulty time articulating this. But the challenge is, I think, as a society, we believe that more officers translates directly to less crime. And that's not a direct correlation there. I'll give you a perfect example. So,
Your point about statistics, you and I talked about this earlier. I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt, it is interesting. I'm thinking of these different books. If you're not careful, more police officers means more crime, not necessarily because there is more crime, but because you're now tracking more crime. Right? More people are going to get arrested if there's more people capable of arresting people. Right? And so anyway, sorry, keep going. So we can play with statistics all day long, and we kind of talked about that.
Your numbers will go up, and I totally get that. But I was going to give it as an example, right? So the Kansas City Chiefs won the Super Bowl. The last Super Bowl they won, they had a victory parade at Union Station.
Yeah.
There were, I don't know what the population or what the crowd numbers were, 500,000, 600,000, somewhere in that neighborhood, right? There was a lot of people in a very small space. And my numbers are off. These are estimates, but
surely it wasn't 500, was it? I mean, that's the whole city of Kansas City. I mean, I don't know. I'm just trying to.
We had a million for the Royals parade in 2015, but I think maybe the Chiefs parades are a little bit smaller. There's just a lot of people. Let's call it 350,000 people, whatever that number is.
No. That's wild to think about, because that's the entire Kansas City metro.
Oh, yeah.
All outside, I get there's people coming in from, but I don't know. I'm just trying to get people's perspective.
There's a lot.
So we're mentally in the right place here, because you're talking about the world where the entire Kansas City downtown metro population, you were to Google this, 500,000.
Yeah.
We're on the streets.
Kansas City proper population was there.
Yeah.
So there were, estimated 20 plus different law enforcement agencies that were represented. From county to federal to state to local, 20 plus agencies.
They pulled in from Liberty, from my understanding, from different surrounding towns. Yeah.
What's the number? 20 different, 25 different, maybe 50 more, whatever the number of staged ambulances that were there ready to respond to any emergency. You had plainclothes officers. You had uniformed officers. You had drones. You had cameras. You had Emergency Operations Center was spun up watching. You have people watching cameras all the time. There was so many eyes on that, and we still had a shooting.
Yeah.
I bring that up because it is the stark reality that it's not a law enforcement issue. It's a human issue.
You're right.
Those individuals, we had more policing for a concentrated event. Unless we had one officer watching every one of those 500,000 people standing behind them, we couldn't have prevented that, right? And I bring that up because we have to begin addressing those issues. And I know it seems like it's an impossible thing to do. You can't change people's, they got free will, they got minds of their own and so forth, right? We can't change that, but we have to start addressing that. We have to start understanding it. Police, by and large, is a reactive force to something that has already occurred. It is not the preventative thing that we're looking for. It has that element, right? But it is, by and large, it's a reactive force. And we have to start thinking about how we use that.
It's a good example. And I could dive right into, so we were talking about the parade. I think it's a beautiful example, right? Because it was citizens that initially tackled these folks, right? For officers to respond. So that's kind of a beautiful thing. And then one thing I actively noted, so I wasn't, for better or worse, better in retrospect, but frankly, I felt bad about it at the time. I didn't go to that parade. And the moment I heard that there might have been a shooting, right, I had the news on. And it was wild to me. The news, the local news is there, is on site. And I was not getting information fast enough. And so I'm literally troubleshooting in my head, how do I get information fast enough than a live stream news outlet that is literally on site? Turns out if you go over to Twitter X and you trending, you've got pictures, you've got comments, you've got I'm alongside the guy. You've also got a hell of a lot of random disinformation that people are just chaotic agents. So, you know, be wary of that. And you don't have that, hopefully, as much with a proper news media outlet. But I was capable of like actually following moment for moment more actively what happened. Because, you know, the citizens that tackled them, for every, you know, I think it was like two or three of them, right? There's 50 more right there with pictures and cell phones and comments. And so it was just kind of wild, because that to me was also an interesting thing to see. You know, you can get the information live and it happens faster when it's open source, when it's just everybody coming together, pooling in raw data.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Well, it's, you know, like I was saying, you know, you had more police eyes on that. You had more visibility on that. And still these individuals chose to commit that terrible act, right? It's a human issue, not a law enforcement issue. And we have to begin figuring out ways to address that. I know it seems like it's insurmountable, but we have to begin thinking about how we get to that. What was it that caused them to do that, or what allowed them to make that their decision matrix, that, you know, that said, this is how we're going to resolve this conflict or whatever else it is.
So I've got one last topic I want to try to tackle before we go into wrap up. And it's because of my note. If I forget my note here, then it's like, I'll remember it later and be like, I never asked him about that. So you talk about this abundance mindset, which I absolutely love that term. Kind of the first question along this line is, where would you say your abundance mindset comes from? I mean, and you'd mentioned a decision at one point to actively like engage and flip it on. Has it just always been on? How have you nurtured that? How have you made sure you're showing up for yourself first?
I think it's a great question. And I think it is caught a bad rap because of, you know, certain either people of note out there or bad press or whatever the case. I think the term abundance mindset gives off a bad taste. I'll say this for me, again, book according to Mike, your abundance mindset does not mean that you've got a overflowing bank account. It doesn't mean that you are, that you're the rich and famous or anything else like that. The abundance mindset comes or starts first with you being enough, right? Every one of us, that's probably the biggest lie any one of us tends to believe, or it's the first lie we believe, is you don't matter. You're not enough. You're not worthy. You're not whatever, right? And if the statement is true, the only person coming to rescue you is the version of yourself that's fed up with it, then you have to understand that that version of you is capable of rescuing you, right? Well, okay, if that is true, then I can't be not enough. I have to matter. I have to have worth. I have to have value if I'm going to be the one that's able to do that kind of rescuing, right? And it's, you know, I think it's interesting, and I dare to even mention this, but I find it interesting in scripture that we see so many times the miracles of Jesus that the Bible says your faith has healed you or made you whole or whatever the case, right? And we're constantly looking for something outside of ourselves to do the saving for us. And I'm not here to say that, you know, fill in the blanks, come, you know, people can come up with their own. But the reality is, I'm kind of all over the map here, but choice is your suman superpower.
Yeah.
You have the ability to choose what you're going to do. You may be a criminal today and choose to run, walk a straight line. Now, you may have consequences to deal with, but your choice is 100% within your power. You could be an IT call taker right now, and you could choose to have a good day and render good service, rendering dignity to everybody that you're doing. I could be a police officer and choose to see everybody as a human being first and deal with their behavior, you know, consequently, right? I have the power to choose, and that choice makes all the difference. It really does become your superpower. And you may have to walk through consequences. You may have to deal with it, and it may suck. You may be in debt up to your eyeballs right now and choose that you want to live a debt-free life. Okay, you're probably going to have to walk through some of the residual effects of those previous choices, but you have the power to choose that. And that understanding that power, understanding that that's within you, not something outside you have to go get, that's where that abundant mindset comes from, or at least that's one of the starting places for it.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. I literally just read a passage this morning where Paul helps heal a layman, and it's very specific. It says he saw through his eyes that his faith was strong enough. And it's just the whole, it's a wild, it's like, okay, so he sees this guy from a distance and, you know, cause it, the indication to me was he was towards the edge of the crowd. And, it seemed pretty clear that it wasn't really about Paul, and, it wasn't about the crowd. It was about the layman capable of, and all Paul said, I shouldn't say all Paul said, but that's really how I read it. That's really the context, is Paul's like, get up, what are you doing? And he did.
He did.
And but prior to that is Paul looking at him, and there must have been some unspoken communication here, right? And this, I could just imagine, like, are you fed up with this? You fed up with the debt? You fed up with the? Are you fed up with that you're on that mat? And you know, guys, yeah, I'm done. It's like, all right, well, what are you doing there? Get up, let's go. And it's a wild thought too. And that's what's wilder is that doesn't work with everyone, right? I can say for me personally, there are times when I joke, I have two friends. I have a tough love friend, and I have one that if I told him I'd killed somebody, he'd probably be there like, all right, I got the shovel. Where you know what I mean? Like, it depends on which one. I have different days. I have days where I'm like, I just want to commiserate, and I want them to agree with me, you know. And then I have days where I call the guy, other guy, right? I'll know he's just going to disagree and tough love everything. If it's like a customer, or if it's a client, or if it's an employee, or whoever it is, he's going to like, I don't think you saw their perspective, which is I need all the time. And then there's times when the other guy is going to like, oh, I mean, you're super cool. Sounds like they were a jerk. And sometimes I need to hear that. So I don't quite know where I'm getting at there, but I guess the point was for the Paul perspective and for that situation, like that's definitely what that gentleman needed. But it's always interesting to me because I don't think that's what everyone needs. And I'm sure there's a good example too of Paul. You know, the only one that comes to my mind is maybe when they're in prison and you know, the guy's upset and they stayed in prison, you know, and the guy's upset. Yeah. They're like, we're still here. You're good. Don't worry about
yeah,
it.
Right. Don't worry about it. Yeah. Don't worry about it. You know, the reality is, and I talk about choice being the superpower, right? And this is, you know, in my coaching, I mentioned that I work exclusively with those individuals that are at that, they've hit a peak, they've hit a ceiling in their progress. They've already experienced substantial growth. They're there, they're being successful by measures, right? But they can't break through the rest of it. Reminding them that they have the power of choice is something that's really interesting because almost all of them feel at that point when they start bumping to the ceiling, feel like they have exercised choice. They've made the decision to do this and this and this and this and this. But being able to walk them through and get that aha moment, so to speak, when they are not, how should I say it? When they are understanding that their choice is what's going to break them through, break them free, it's been great. It's been fantastic.
Yeah. That time I need to close some windows or something. So you were saying that you were talking through the superpower.
Yeah. The choice. The fact that it's choice, right? Your ability to choose means that you are, and I'm probably saying something that we should probably spend time unpacking, but we don't have time. But
yeah,
when you make a choice, you are assuming an identity of something. You're choosing to go this direction. So that's how you will behave. That's the perspective and everything that you will assume. You'll don that cloak of whatever that choice says. We forget because we get so ingrained in that choice and chasing that choice and pursuing that choice and living that choice. We forget that it was just a dang choice, right?
Yeah.
We forget that we can take that choice off and make another choice, don a whole nother identity into this. And, you know, part of it is one of the things I tell in my coaching is like, you have to be willing to give up who you are to become who you will be. And if you can't take that cloak off to don this one, you'll be stuck in between the two. And it will not just be challenging, it'll be excruciating. Because you'll have your foot in two camps and you won't be committed to either one of them. And part of that is, you know, that's the transition point, which is always challenging. But people forget. And like I said this earlier, right? For those people trying to break through that last 5%, unlock that last 5%, surrender is the toughest thing that they will ever do because you don't do anything to surrender, right?
Yeah. And
that just messes people's minds up.
That's good. So this has been great, Mike. I really appreciate having you on. So there's two questions we like to kind of wrap things up with. So the first question is, we have a motto over here. If we've seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Originally Isaac Newton, but oh my goodness, in the nature of the quote, it has so much more history than that. But he's the one credited with it, saying, if I have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Who's been a giant in your life that you'd like to pay homage to in this moment?
Yeah, I'd have to say my dad. He's since passed away, but he was the first one that just showed me it doesn't cost anything to be nice. And recognizing people's humanity. We grew up in a small town, and he would recognize people's humanity no matter where you were. And recognizing humanity did not mean, if you knew who Charles Grigsby was, did not mean that you got a free pass. He would jump square in the middle of you, even if he didn't know you, and kind of call you on the carpet of, is this the kind of person you want to be? So I got to see that growing up, and he exemplified that. No.
That's good. And the second one is, if you had a general saying or pithy statement, one of those the grass is always greener on the other side style statements that you've just found to be true for your life again and again and again, personal or professional, what would that be?
It's actually two. There is no place called smooth sailing, and everything is subject to change.
There's no place called smooth sailing, and everything is subject to change.
You know what's funny, and I know we're wrapping up here, but what's funny is if anybody who knows the story of the Israelites being freed from Egypt and finally after 40 years wandering in the desert, they make it to the promised land. Do you know what the first thing they got to do in the promised land? You know what they were rewarded with in the promised land, the land flowing with milk and honey? Is they had to go fight the battle of Ai. They had to go fight. Yeah. The very first thing that they had to do once they got to the promised land, they had to go fight. There is no place called smooth sailing.
I'm kind of in awe. Yeah. There's a lot of that. And it's I was just thinking about this morning, the rebirth, the Phoenix, it's a recurring theme, right? It makes every good. We have the hero's journey that is just, you have the valley, we have to all go through it. Frodo had to go through Mordor to make it. And it's just every good story again and again and again. And it, because it's life, we have to go through suffering for rebirth. But to your point, it's always so interesting, at the moment of peak possible suffering, when you're sure you're done, there's just a little bit more. There's that glass ceiling or whatever you've still got to punch through. That's and right. Then you're on the other side, and you don't, half the time you don't even realize you made it through.
The old saying is that the first thing you see when you get to the top of the mountain is the tops of other mountains, right? So there's more that you got to go climb.
And to your credit in coaching, the beautiful thing that I've noticed, it's not the notice of the mountain. It's not the ability to go climb. That's all fantastic. For me, the more you experience growth and the more you make that your calling, the harder it seems to be to see. And maybe this is a me thing. It used to be easy. These are all my problems. Fix my problems. But the more problems you start fixing with yourself, it seems like sooner or later, you're like, there's still definitely problems, but now it's becoming harder and harder to tell. You need that external influence. You need that coach. You need that mentor. You need that group to, hey, Sam, this is what you're clearly overlooking.
Well, I'm gonna give away my age now, but back in the early 90s, right, we had computer discs called Norton Antivirus. And you had these discs for the purpose of cleaning up your computer. But if you booted off your computer while running that disc, it could only search and actually clean proverbial 95% of your computer because you were having to run off of your own hard drive.
Yeah.
You had to get an external disk, boot up off of the disk in order to get 100% for the disk and for the software to look at 100% of what was going on in your computer. That's the same thing, right? You need that last 5%. You do need you don't need an external savior. What you do need is an external Sherpa. And I use that word specifically, right? A Sherpa going up Mount Everest is at the same peril as anybody else going up the mountain. They've just done it enough that they know what to trust and what not to trust, and they can help you. They don't do the climbing for the hikers. They don't do the work is still being done, but they can say, hey, I've stepped on that kind of rock before and it doesn't work. You should step here. Hey, I've grabbed for that kind of thing before. Hey, I've taken a break here and it usually tends to work. Like, that's the point of the Sherpa, and you do need that because you have not traversed that peak before.
That's good. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mike. I've really appreciated having you.
Sam, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it. This was great.
Bye, everybody.
Hello, everybody. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.